From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson. Producer Megan Mack is off this week. And we'll get right to some of the standout moments from this week on Connections. Let's start with a remarkable young man who is a native of Puerto Rico and moved with his family to Rochester when he was 8 years old. His name is Santos Cruz, and he's become a well-regarded entertainer and artist in Rochester. He performed some spoken word for us, and he'll be part of the 2016 holiday celebration next week for La Cumbre, an organization that seeks to lift up Latino voices in Rochester. Now, you might recall that WXXI recently released our year-long investigation into the lack of diversity on local teaching staffs. Santos had a lot to say about that and how he was impacted as a young student in local schools.
It was one of those things where I did have a teacher that spoke Spanish, Latino teacher, you know, and they would separate you to a different room to be able to interpret different classes and whatnot. But I think that the battle becomes that as soon as you get here, the time clock starts kicking. And it's like, it feels, in my opinion, my personal opinion, it feels like you have but so much time before you enter middle school to learn English and be efficient at it. Otherwise, a lot of doors get closed. You know what I mean? Because people feel like because you don't know English that you're not intelligent or you're not smart. In my example, I really struggled with English for years, you know, but my normal classes, I'm getting straight A's. I'm getting B's, you know what I mean? So I couldn't really get into the honor classes or the high honor classes to get a different level of education because of the lack of English. So I felt that I had to learn English as quick as possible. And you know, I mean, it's having a teacher that knows that struggle is more patient with you, regardless of the color, really. But having someone there represent you and you could look at it, you know my struggle, you know my pain, you know how it is from my tongue itself to pronounce certain letters, certain words, you know, and having that teacher with patience sitting next to you just makes things feel a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not sitting here saying that what we learned over the last year is that white teachers can't teach effectively students of color. That's not true. And we taught some wonderful examples of that. But what we do see in that underrepresentation are those moments that students occasionally feel, like you just mentioned, judged simply because your English isn't very good. And all of a sudden people make an assumption about who you are and your intelligence. That has to be tough.
When you're talking and mumbling through words, all you have to go by is not only how I look, but how I sound when I speak. So if I speak and I sound like I'm fetching for words, I'm mumbling, I'm stuttering, I really can't pronounce certain words, it really reflects on your lack of education. Now, people tend to generalize it as a lack of your whole general education, which is just, in fact, a lack of your mispronunciation or your might be slight education on linguistics alone. You know what I mean? That has nothing to do with my math abilities because math is universal. It has nothing to do with my science because science is universal. It has nothing to do with my history because history is universal. You know what I mean? But people judge you based on how hard you sound. And that's just, I mean, I wish I had an answer for that, but I don't.
Let's turn our attention to a conversation with Dr. Marvin McMichael, the president of Colgate-Rochester-Crozer Divinity School. Dr. McMichael joined us to talk about his recent essay regarding the results of the presidential election. In the clip you're about to hear, he's responding to a caller. That caller was a young woman of color who explained that she chose not to vote at all. She's not even registered to vote, and she doesn't feel that elections give her any voice or representation. Dr. McMichael had a lot to say about that.
Not to vote is to vote. When you don't vote, when you don't stand up and cast a vote, you have voted. You have voted by your absence. There's an ancient notion that not to decide is to decide. So by her not voting, she has impacted nothing except made it more likely that the very person she was against is going to have a chance to win. It is, for me, preposterous to think that Donald Trump would have been a better outcome for people of color, for Native Americans, and for other oppressed groups than Hillary Clinton. It is not true to say that she has done nothing for people of color. She began her whole career going into Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, testing integration in public schools. She worked for the Children's Defense Fund. She voted throughout all of her career to advocate both in Arkansas and then as the First Lady and then as a New York Senator to advocate for the inclusion of all persons. So I want to tell you a story, if I might, and your listeners. I have a great uncle that I discovered in a genealogical study. His name was Edward Donahue from Kentucky. He was born in Kentucky in 1870. In 1930, he went to register to vote for the first time. It took him 60 years to get the courage to go. This was in Madison County, Kentucky. He went to the registrar and said he had come to vote. He was told that Ins, I won't use the full word, Ins cannot vote in Kentucky. He said, well, I've come to change that. And then he was told that Ins do not vote in Kentucky. And then the third time he asked to register to vote, he was shot dead by the registrar right on the spot. They took the registrar to jail. He pled self-defense against an unarmed man and was released without any charge, without any consequence. 1930, black people were being shot on the spot for daring to lay claim to the right to vote. Now their great-grandchildren are walking away from the right to vote because they don't have their preferred candidate or because they don't think that this person is as aggressive as they wish they would be. I understand her frustration. I only hope that she will understand the frustration of my generation in her answer that too much work went into getting the right to vote to so glibly and callously cast it aside and to say that you don't have anyone to vote for. By not voting, we get Donald Trump's cabinet. By not voting, we get Donald Trump.
Speaking of the election, there is a group of buses going from Rochester to Washington for the inauguration of Donald Trump next month. Some buses will no doubt carry supporters, but a good number of buses will carry demonstrators who will join the National Women's March. Before they leave, they're going to get a training from Kit Miller, the director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit joined us on Connections to explain her series of trainings about how to recognize hate and what we can do about it.
I had the privilege of going down to Washington myself just after the election and to a conference that was organized by George Mason Center for Conflict Studies and Martin Luther King III. And part of the draw for me was the timing, and also Johann Galtung was there, who was sort of globally renowned as the father of peace building as a field of studies. And he's just brokered some extraordinary peace deals over the years. I mean, he's very old, and I was just thrilled to be in the room with the man. And one of the things that he said, he strongly urged people to be nonviolent with words. He said, don't criticize others. He said, because very few people have become good by being told they are bad. So this is a guy that's thought about how do we cut across differences and figure out ways to keep people safe for decades and decades. So I just wanted to share that little quote from him. It was a thrill for me to be in the room. You know, I've been studying nonviolence for more than 20 years, and one of the things that rings in my ears just about every single day is King's admonition to pay attention to issues instead of personalities. So looking underneath to what are the issues of the day and what are the issues of our time, not just the personality of he said, she said, who's in office, who's getting kicked out of office. So the issue of hate months ago seemed pertinent as the rhetoric was kicking in terms of the election. So from a couple different sources, I really became interested in trying to bring people together to talk about hate. And I didn't do it because I'm an expert on hate. I did it mainly I brought my questions and my facilitation skills to the conversation. And it's been a very rich journey to bring, I think at this point, close to 80 people together. And we look at hate. I was inspired in part by reading Howard Thurman, who is an extraordinary figure of the 20th century. And he was a friend of Martin Luther King's father, a mentor to King. He wrote a book called Jesus and the Disinherited, and quite a bit of Thurman's work is actually dedicated to the issue of hate. Thurman talked about the dangers of when hate becomes respectable in society. And it seemed to me even months ago that that's where we were heading, that hate had become respectable. And so I just thought, you know, I think we need to get together and talk about hate, because Thurman also spoke about that most people's reactions to hate were woefully inadequate. All we do is say it's bad, and then we turn our face away. And oftentimes that allows hateful conditions, hateful speech, hateful acts to flourish, because the vast majority of people just turn their face away because they don't want to acknowledge hate, or all they want to do is push it away. So I thought, you know what? I want to get people together to start really getting interested in hate, to identify hate within ourselves. What does self-hate have to do with hatred? I think for many of us, the issues that we have in terms of loving ourselves are at risk. You know, the admonition, love your neighbor as yourself. I think many of us do. We kind of hate ourselves and we sometimes hate our neighbors. So this is a whole issue that I've gotten really involved in. And so it's been, we just did a workshop this past Saturday, which was filmed. And we're going to be doing another event on Saturday, January 7th over at the Gandhi Institute, 2:30 to 5:30. If anyone's interested, you can jump on our website at GandhiInstitute.org.
Next up, we discussed a UBI that stands for Universal Basic Income. Entrepreneur Elon Musk recently said that robots and automation could mean that we'll never see the American workforce recover to previous levels of employment. This could be the tipping point, Musk said. And so what can we do? One idea is to offer a universal basic income. There are lots of ways to do that, but the basic idea is to have the government provide a set annual income for all citizens, somewhere around the poverty line. You'll hear first from Amit Badabial, a professor of economics at RIT, and then you'll hear Peter Nabosny from the Center for Governmental Research.
I remember an article, because I've done some reading on this, in the 1920s in the New York Times, which again said job losses were here to stay and we needed to do something seriously to address the job loss problem because of automation. Same thing happened in the 1960s. Once again, with the advent of personal computers, similar concerns arose. But the fact of the matter is, thus far at least, there is no reason to believe that the job losses are going to be so large and so widespread that something like a UBI is basically called for. So if you want to stay with the Elon Musk line of rationale, what people who want a UBI, and the rationale for the UBI is basically widespread job losses, a dystopian vision of the future, they have to make an affirmative case that this time is really different.
This is the disruptive
point. Exactly. That this time is really different and that the historical evidence doesn't really help us much because this time is really different. But I have not seen any evidence to suggest that this time is really different.
Okay. Pete, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I mean, there was a good article in The Atlantic about a year ago, maybe, that used the analogy, you know, that exactly to your point, Amit, that there's been this kind of boy that cried wolf element to all of this for you know, 200 years now. I mean, but, you know, the author also made the point that eventually there was a wolf in that story.
Amit's saying we don't know that this is the wolf.
So
maybe the wolf is coming.
Perhaps not. I mean, there is evidence out there. If you look at things like labor force participation rates that have been declining in the U.S. among prime age working individuals, particularly men, that have been declining for 50, 60 years now. One of every six prime age men, which is really the 25 to 64, 55 age men, aren't in the workforce today. So they're not unemployed necessarily, but there's this whole swath of people who aren't working. That was offset for a while by women entering the workforce, but that's declining as well. And so you are seeing changes in the nature of our working economy that exist. And then when you start looking towards, and I'm by no means sold on all of this, but when you start looking towards the types of technological innovations that we see coming down the road in the next few years, driverless cars, the biggest employer of high school educated, or the biggest job category of high school educated men in the U.S. today is truck drivers. And most people think that that technology is going to come to trucks, you know, pretty soon. You have things like Amazon's experimenting with a store in Seattle where someone swipes their Amazon Prime card or whatever it is when they enter, and they just grab items off the shelf and walk out. 10% of our economy is employed in retail jobs today, and sales jobs and cashiers and things like that. And sure, there would be some replacement. Those people would find some other amount of work, but some of the scale of the types of technologies that seem to be coming online in the near future could be quite disruptive. And I think that part of the appeal of a UBI program is to say there is going to be great disruption in our economy. People will lose jobs, and that's a constant thing. And this provides some kind of cushion, support, smoothing effect so that people aren't completely destitute when their industry becomes absolutely obsolete.
Let's wrap the week with a little music. You know the song, Baby It's Cold Outside. Well, a pair of singer-songwriters named Lila and Josiah decided they would write an updated version. They thought the originals become too closely evocative of date rape, of sexual assault. That's because the man in the original keeps pressing the woman to stay, even after she said no, and the woman eventually wonders what's in her drink. Well, here's part of the new version of the song.
I really can't stay.
Baby, I'm fine with that.
I've got to go away.
Baby, I'm cool with that.
This evening has been so very nice.
I'm glad you had a real good time.
My mother will start to worry.
Call her so she knows that you're coming.
My father will be pacing the floor.
Better get your car up.
So really I'd better scurry.
No rush.
Should I use the front or back door?
Which one are you pulling towards?
The neighbors might think
that you're a real nice girl.
Say, what is this drink?
Pomegranate LaCroix.
I wish I knew how.
Maybe I'll help you
to
out.
Break this spell.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I ought to say no, no, no,
you
sir.
You reserve the right to say no.
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
You reserve the right to say no.
I really can't stay.
Well, you don't have to.
Ah, oh, but it's cold outside.
And here's Lila offering her take on the history of the song and the new version she helped write.
For us, it was just like a fun bin that we could do to raise awareness.
Okay, but you know, Lydia and Josiah, that there are critics who really do feel, in fact, I've got a pile of response to this that have come in from various forms just before the show began. So, for example, Jerry writes to us, says, I remember hearing the song and thinking things sure were challenging for women while dating, so I never put it on in my kids' Christmas music repertoire. I try not to go out of my way to be offended, but I just couldn't let my kids listen to the original version. Aggression and dominance can be subtle, and songs are a conduit for that subtlety to seep into our accepted cultural norms, whether we realize it or not. And another, a listener who wanted the name excluded, just writes and says, I'm a rape survivor. In the song, she says no. He continues to ask, to me it's indicative of rape culture, end quote. Whereas Elizabeth writes to us and says, while I understand how people can interpret the song otherwise, I'm not dark on it. Seems like the girl is more worried about being seen as that kind of girl, but is having fun, and I enjoy most versions of it. So some of the harsher critiques there. Josiah, do you line up with the harsher critiques that say the song feels like rape culture or not?
I do, because I feel like in the 1940s context, it was a great anthem for feminism, and it was good for people to hear in that time because they would hear it with the understanding that the woman wants to be there. But, you know, context and culture changes, and nowadays people who don't understand the context of 1940s don't hear it that way. So, and we hear it as, why can't you just leave?
All right, so what you're doing is you're accepting that the original historical premise was potentially, even as a feminist, kind of a song, but given the fact that most of us don't have that frame of reference anymore, you think it can do more harm than good?
Yeah, I do think so. And also, it's always up for interpretation for the listener. If they like the original version more because they are able to see it in its original context, then, go for it. More power to you. You can listen to that. We're not saying we want to change it forever.
Sure.
It's just a fun update.
Okay. Lydia, what do you think?
I agree with everything Josiah said. I think we don't have that frame of reference, and I think it's heard completely differently now.
That's it for this edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will be back with you on Monday.